volunteering with CIO today, the Center for Intercultural Organizing. I'm also an organizer with TransUnity. I'm just going to kind of go over a story that happened 3 years ago or 2.5 years ago, like right when I moved to Portland from Southern California. I was really excited to get here. Everyone was talking about Portland's transgender community and how accepting Portland is, and it's really exciting. It was literally about a week and a half after I got here. I was pulled over for driving 5 miles under the speed limit. A cop took a look at me and was really aggressive when asking for my ID, and was getting really loud and intense and asked me if I had a record and was asking me what was on my record and just kind of kept asking me. And when I told him I didn't, he didn't believe me. I gave him my name because I couldn't find my ID, and I kind of kept scrounging through the car, and so was my partner, but it was getting just really nervous and heavy. And while he started writing my name down, because I didn't think he was going to do that, I said, "Oh, actually, my legal name is," and it's a female. It was a female's name. And he said, he was like, "Oh, your legal name?" And he said, "I'll be right back." And when he said, "I'll be right back," he sounded relatively calm in how he had been acting. And when he came back, he reached his hand through my window and unlocked the car from the inside and opened the door and told me I was arrested for lying to an officer. And I was in total shock, and he dragged me by my shirt, even though I was like willing to go with him. And he was pulling me so hard, my feet were dragging on the ground. And him and his partner, who was at the car, put me in the car. They gave my partner a breathalyzer to make sure she was able to drive, which seemed kind of strange. And after, when he brought me into jail, he first put me in a detention by myself for my own safety, is what he was saying, which, you know, he didn't ask me what I wanted to do or anything. What it seemed like for a few hours, I was in a room by myself. After a few hours, he took me out of there, and he brought me to a different building. And when he brought me to a building, and keep in mind this was like 3 years ago, so I looked a little different. When I walked into the room, I think it was like the county building at this point, he handed me off to another officer, and the officer said, "Is this a chick or a man?" And the arresting officer said, "That's the thing." Whatever that meant. And so the new officer was taking me and frisking me, and while he was frisking me, you know, I'm not going to repeat any of the way he phrased this, but he kept asking me what was between my legs, and he kept kind of like pretending to grab my crotch and implying that if I didn't tell him what was between my legs, he was going to figure it out. This was going on for like quite some time, the frisking, and a female officer actually ended up whispering to me that I could choose which holding cell to go into, whether it was a male or female holding cell, and explained that the male holding cell had 22 people, if that impacted my decision. And the only thing that, at that point, that really impacted my decision was that these officers had outed me, and there were 6 men also waiting that had been arrested that were waiting to go back into holding cells. And this had become such a big thing, and that they were yelling about my genitalia and using really provocative words to talk about my genitalia. So I decided to go into the women's holding cell. And this became like a whole huge complicated mess. After getting out like 24 hours later, all I could think about was like how to hold these police accountable. But there was really nothing I could do. I ended up doing community service. A year later, my wages got garnished because I was driving 5 miles under the speed limit and didn't know I had a ticket for that. It was just like this huge, crazy thing. And I can't imagine if there was something I could feel about police accountability later. And no matter, you know, where I turned to, there was really nothing I could do. So that's just one reason why this is really important.
My name is Zev. I'm the organizing director for the Urban League of Portland. You know, today being in this room, hearing all these amazing stories and horrible stories, really made me try to think about the larger scale issue here. My entire life has been defined by profiling. We can't untie a racist history of prejudice from the realities and difficulties we're facing today. The Ku Klux Klan was the first institution of police force in this country, and we can't forget that is a legacy that has never been ended. It's been slowed down, it's been hindered, it's never been stopped. The first time, actually I want to tell you a story of like two boys, right? The first time I got pulled over by police, I was 14 years old, I, you know, hopped a train rail or something. My friend Manuel was with me and he looked white. I was thrown against a wall, patted down, told that I was going to go to juvie, threatened with all kinds of things. Luckily, my mother picked up the second time we called, and she was able to convince the officer, and he told her, because I was so well-spoken and respectful, that I would get to go. Manuel was not respectful. He was angry, he was fighting back, he wouldn't give them his parents' phone number, but he also got to go. And the lesson that I came away from that was, if I conform, if I do what I'm told and be who I'm told to be, I can survive. I can move on. I can be successful. Manuel was told that because he's white, he has the right to fight. When I got home, my father said, "Welcome to being black." And that wasn't like a bad thing. That was an affirmation. Every black person in this room has faced profiling. So I got to be a part of that community all of a sudden and feel that solidarity. But at the same time, my father also told me, "You are too big and you are too black to commit crime. They're watching you, they will find you, and they will stop you every time." And that's something I carried with me my entire life. Every time I was confronted with power, every time I was confronted by people who didn't see me as the same, I learned to conform. I learned to give them what they wanted to see so that I could be successful and be the man I am today so that I can fight back now. My cousin, on the other hand, we grew up in the same city, same time, same age, both mixed race, same neighborhood. His parents, the first time he got arrested, he got picked up by the cops for riding in a stolen car. His parents didn't pick up because they were addicted to crack. And he went to juvie. And then he came out. And then he was suspended from school over and over. And he kept going back and in and out. Now he is addicted to heroin and in prison. Our life outcomes are radically different based on one act of profiling. My aunt, who has her master's degree and is a tenured professor in nursing, almost didn't graduate from nursing school because she was black, because one professor told her, "Well, N-words can't be nurses." She didn't have one white advocate, one ally. My entire family's outcome would have been radically different. None of us would be here today. That is a history and a trauma that has traveled both with the police force and with us to this day, and we can't forget that. We can't walk away from that and say, "Oh, well, these problems are all of a sudden happening." They've never stopped, and until we make a clean break from our history, we're never gonna change. Thank you.
Good evening, my name's Jerry Jimenez. I was asked to come here tonight to describe why I believe I've been profiled in my past. Everyday people are profiled for many reasons. In the past, I was profiled as a welfare mom, a homeless person, a convict, a prostitute, a battered woman, a person struggling with mental illness who could only get so far in life, a Native American person, the wife, mother, and grandmother of an African American family. All of these stereotype labels have been applied to me in my life. No matter how hard being called these things hurt, the worst hurt of all is to be targeted by a person who's been placed in a position of power to protect and serve you with the taxpayers' money. If I was standing in a line with spending WIC vouchers and the other folks in line shift their heads and sigh, I can get over that much faster than when an officer is screaming in my face and threatening me, or neglects to file a police report because of how they see me. I had to file a complaint as a woman of color in 2005 as I was trying to help a young girl get away from her pimp, and the pimp kept calling me to tell me to come home so he could shoot me. He left evidence on the porch, and the police lost the evidence and never filed the complaint. Because they looked at my record, they didn't hear a word I said. I was just some old hoe who probably wouldn't follow through on pressing charges, so they never bothered to file the complaint. This pimp harassed me for over a month, threatening my life, and I had to move my children. I filed another lawsuit with a police officer who was screaming at me, saying people like me should know better, when we were having a discussion about fishing. People like me meaning Native American people. In 2013, my son filed a police report for excessive use of force against the Portland police, who exonerated themselves. Almost everyone on the Citizens Review Committee was a white male lawyer and agreed that in effort to keep my son safe, the police beat him, hogtied him, and strapped him into the back of the patrol car after he was already detained and on his way to the jail less than 5 minutes away. The Citizens Review Committee said it was reasonable to believe that he could have been hurt in that way. I said it was reasonable to believe that the police beat people up in the neighborhoods that I lived in because I've seen it hundreds and hundreds of times.
Yeah, for the record, my name is Quentin Blanton, and I'm here today to inform you of why holding law enforcement accountable is absolutely necessary. As an undergrad, I attended George Fox University, a small and predominantly white Christian liberal arts college in Newburgh, Oregon. Unfortunately, my overall experience while attending this university was terrible because of the racism I experienced from other students, various staff members, some professors, and many residents in the city of Newburgh. I endured racism on a daily basis the entire 5 years I went to George Fox. If it wasn't the staff being racist towards myself or African Americans in general, it was a professor. If it wasn't a professor, it was a student. And if it wasn't a student, it was the Newburgh police, who have to date provided me with my most traumatic and racist experiences. There were several instances during my freshman and sophomore years while a student at George Fox and living in Newburgh that I was pulled over or stopped by police and asked to provide them with my identification card. On some of these occasions, I was with friends, and on others, I was by myself. Out of all the times I was stopped, however, neither my friends nor I were found to be committing any crimes, and at the time, none of us had criminal records. Many people who deny the fact that racism exists in America and its extent would probably assume that the officers were just doing their job, or those who don't believe that law enforcement racially profile people would try to pinpoint me as being wrong or responsible in some way for being stopped. However, I totally disagree. Racism is deeply operative in every aspect of American society and culture, including but not limited to economics, education, entertainment, labor, law, politics, religion, and health. A recent incident in which I was racially profiled by law enforcement was in Tigard, Oregon. I was canvassing with a group called Osberg and was instructed to go off and canvass on my own for a while. Shortly after knocking on a few doors, I had the police called on me because, according to the person who called the police, I looked suspicious and looked like I didn't belong in the neighborhood. Luckily, the police officer who came was nice, and after a brief conversation said to me, "You clearly look like you're canvassing and not starting any trouble," and he let me go. This is evidence to me that there are good cops who genuinely want to protect and serve the people, but unfortunately, police stops don't always end this way. I am certain that the Newburgh police consistently harassed and targeted me because I am a black male, which makes me somebody they feel must be harmed at their discretion and whenever possible. One of the most terrifying encounters I had with Newburgh police was on an evening when I was walking home from the gym. I was about halfway home when a squad car with two officers in it drove up on the side of me. The officer who was driving slowed the car to the pace I was walking, and both officers were looking at me like they wanted to kill me. I was horrified, but I continued walking and stared back at them. After about 20 seconds of eye contact between the officers and I, the driving officer began to speed up and slow down in short spurts. After terrorizing me for about 1 minute, the officers sped off with their red and blue lights on. I was so scared after they left, I ran the remaining distance home, breathing heavily and feeling unsafe and shaking. I was also racially profiled on the night of November 24, 2012. I was walking home from a friend's house. When I got a couple of houses down from where I lived, a police car turned the corner and drove past me head on. After the officers drove about 100 yards past me, they turned off their headlights, turned on their red and blue lights, and began speeding towards me. The driving officer jumped out of the car with his hands on his utility belt. I asked, "What's the problem, officer?" To which he responded by saying, "You were walking in the middle of the street." I replied, "No, I was not." That's when the officer drew his gun, pointed it at me, and began walking towards me. I tried running home, but I ended up running into my neighbor's yard. While frantically yelling for help, an officer approached me with his flashlight in my face, threw me to the ground, and twisted my arm behind my back so hard that I felt my rotator cuff in my left shoulder tear. I immediately told the officers about the pain I was in, but I was not offered any medical attention. I was stood up and escorted by an officer to the street with about 10 or more officers surrounding me. I asked why I was stopped, and an officer replied, "You were in the street." I then said, "No, I was not. This is not right." An officer then blurted out, "Jesus, you guys need to stop blaming everybody else for what happens to you and take responsibility for you guys' actions. You all would be better off if you just did that." One officer decided to reinforce that particular officer's statement by mumbling under his breath, "That's right, N-word." It's needless to say that I was stunned that my beliefs were confirmed, that the people who were supposed to be serving and protecting me were in fact racist and hated black people. Once at the booking station, I asked for the badge cards of all the officers who were involved in my arrest, but they all refused to provide me with them. I asked one last time for the arresting officer's badge cards before leaving the booking station, to which Sergeant Mark Cook responded by posturing himself as a stereotypical black man and saying, "The name is Officer Cook." Officer Paul Repent and Sergeant Mark Cook are two officers I remember as being particularly disrespectful, vile, and racist on this night. And Officer Paul Repent was the driving officer in both of the aforementioned incidents that occurred in Newburgh. Thank you again for taking the time to listen to my story. I hope hearing my testimony, as well as the testimonies of other people here tonight, will help you to better understand that police enforcement in the state of Oregon is deeply flawed.
Good afternoon, Attorney General and Committee. For the record, my name is Joanne Hardesty. You have an enormous task in a very short time period, so I won't tell you stories because there's enough of those real-life stories here in the room, but I want to give you some facts. Since 2001, Portland police have been keeping data on who they stop. And consistently, if you're African-American, you're twice as likely to be stopped. You're twice as likely to be searched if you're stopped. And you're twice as likely to not have any drugs, guns, or other paraphernalia on you. If you're Latino, it's 1.7 times. But let me tell you, I don't trust the Latino numbers. I think they hide them in the white numbers. But Portland police own data tells you they're 1.7 times more likely to be stopped and searched. If you're part of the gang enforcement team, 44% of the people you stop are African American in a city where 4% of the population is African American. And so I want to encourage you, collecting data is not the issue. We already know.